A neglected pavement led her along row houses like bludgeoned caskets, and shipyards gone to dogs, and tugs dissolute and tilting from their keels. A watchtower from before the devastation laid to rest in hogwire like a capsized lamp. To be a Joan Arc, the Mig Eldigan had said saved a great nation, she could hardly shrink from the ruined precincts. And what were they but dungeons of the heart, incarnated in iron and stone? Eldigan had opened out the tome of pre-devastation paintings and tapped a fat finger, grumbling in the rusty moth trap of his throat. This Mig reminded him of her. Her name was Joan Arc. She delivered a great nation from jeopardy. Her skin was pale, lips ruby. Eldigan showed her another painting. Joan Arc trussed to a post, wreathed in flames, face raised as if to a lover under faintly blooded clouds. She skirted low rises, amassing banks of trumpet brush, broken mesh and staves, and she forded a stone bridge over greasy pools. A bald land race led her through an echoing passage, puddled and strewn and rust-flaked. Upon a terrace, severed by a gully choked with broken baskets and roof tiles and cobblestones, gusts raked back her hair. Beyond the ruin, over cloudbusters with their piles in the sea and cable cars pinned at intervals, a flash storm was arching like pale jaguars smudged with coal oil. In the distance, the cross city rail labored, blue-plumed and thumping. She took square timber steps down between slabs and wall gaps filled with stairways and injured displays. And there they lounged, bald, small-mouthed children posing along a wall, and lankier, top-knotted yeggs perching on heaps of rubble, long-armed and dangling odd trinkets, shirtless or wearing garments sewn from stolen rags, hands and arms tattooed with stars and numerals. One tilted up a bottle of fortified ale. It clinked to broken tile. He scuffed his heel. Another gouged the stony meal by his leg. A stripling pushed a smoking butt to his mouth, the tiny hand trembling and fragile like an infant's. He held her in a steady and melancholic regard. A thin-armed yegg, crouching in a hollow under rusted pipes, thrust his chin and peeped, querulous and urgent. His cheekbones jutted and his eyes were dolorous and gray. His colorless lips kept up their nickering, part derision, part imploration. She was close enough to run her palm over his skull. She saw herself as if from above, the collapsed parasol brushing her leg, her pumps jingling broken tiles, her face, the lipstick a shade called fearless in its pale center, gliding past his, looking into his, turning from his. She walked until catcalls broke to savage merriment behind a ridge of multiple peaks. In sorrel baths, frogs exchanged coarse murmurs. Crackbeaks were repeating liquid trills. The parasol shook. The ruin ended. Myrtle-collared palms lined the thoroughfare. Down the length of a wall ran the watchword, "He is coming," and a tire was trickling smoke. Her heels broke glass as she stepped around a steam buggy with its windshield caved in. She could breathe now, gazing into the tradesmen's fantastic darkened shops, reeking of grease, the beautiful skates lean and shirtless and smoking behind outrageous banks of tools and fixtures spilling into a craze of wire, iron cadavers, buckets of nails, broken carts and heaps of wood and stripped rubber. She crossed under the tattered leonine image upon the blade-crowned wall, her pumps knocking under the languid, contemptuous face, puckered and torn, repeating itself alongside the street where brown leaves slid like crescents of cut leather. I can now see objects as they are, that black landrace nosing the refuse, the wastrel slumped and rubbing his heel, the waitresses dozing on their arms like pigeons with folded wings. Did Joan not require a sporadic rebirth from the catatonia of unease? Did she point out the man and usher him into her tent before each battle? One morning, as she had climbed over the rail outside the flat, with her hand on the rail, she had edged over a Pacific rush, fishing for a garment. The day after she'd married, she'd washed bowls and burnt pots from the wedding feast. She had gone to the village to buy meat and vegetables. While the pot simmered, she scrubbed feculent grease behind the stove. He came in late. He had white liquor with his stew.
What is this?
Goat.
And?
A bit of pepper. I got a price on...
Did you walk to the market?
I caught a lift.
With who?
Badshine. He clenched the spoon, his face long as if squeezed between walls. A high bulge started the ramp of his nose, and his eyes, glazed in some kill of strife, looked through and not at, disacknowledging present objects.
From today, go by foot. Did you spend it all?
Yes, Lee.
All of it? I am not a rich man. I will not have a wife who spends while I labor. Nor an idle one. Tomorrow you will order that area and back. I mean to till and for you to plant. In good weather, and this is bloody good, use the charcoal burner, save on wood oil.
Veins bulged rhythmically at his temple, and his spoon clicked as he bent over the bowl on a table surfaced in white pre-devastation tiles and grouted seams. Hip level along the wall ran a double row of hubcaps of ancient motor buggies dug from the ruins high on Utterjabbok Cay. Later, he undid the line of tin buttons in his goat-hair drugget. His shoulders were scarred and hardened and abscessed. His trousers of brown canvas called brass pants hissed down his thighs. In the wedge-shaped window behind him, built around buggy glass, a sprig of oleander lolled in the light of a naphtha lamp that her father had won off a sailor, glimmered between broken slats of the tumble-down fence that separated Slee's holdings from her father's. The long-faced man rolled a cigarette and lowered himself into the wooden tub. What else was he but the outcome of her battle with old Neen, her father? The hard, violent angel of a reckoning forged in the conviction that she should learn her place, realigning the points of a fundamental order. In the last act, squeezing a sponge over the shining, lumpy shoulders, she located her willingness. I will try, I will try, I will try, I will try. A mastering of darkness through a closing of the eyes, even as the Kay partridge will remain frozen as you grasp its tail.
Howbeit, under the cover of her, I will try. Another instinct operated, or for what purpose had she misinstructed Slee about the pennies? By mid-morning, the instinct had taken over, to the point of impelling her over the rutted track that led along Row Oaks to the village, which abutted the wharf, the woven strap of the canvas bag over her shoulder. Within the bag, a last gift from her friend Y, who had left, escaped, Utterjabbok K, was a blouse, a neckerchief, hairbrush, and pins, and the pennies. She had not packed it. She'd been perching on the sawbuck, pushing barrel gut in a tub of brine, the door open, its iron ring shining, spiked to heavy oak. She thought, I'll just step through to get away from this stinking gut. As she passed the iron rings, her hidden part, still under cover of, I will try, chose its moment. Grab the bag. Just keep walking. Don't stop. Be quick. You will not get a second chance. Watching her alien feet stepping over the moke's shit apples, she thought, Slee, don't you lose a wheel pin. If I catch sight of you, I will throw this bag. I'll say I was going for victuals. Oh, if you catch me, you will take me to school, if not murder me where I stand. I tried to be that, but I can't be. Stepping from the ferry over a narrow, flashing channel, the reel of her mind had not ceased to mill its own astonishment and guilt. I tried to be that. I couldn't. I found that I could not be that. I could not be a drying shell which you pop with your thumb. A womb curling as it dies and offers itself for the sake of a row of hard beans in an endless concatenated procession. She climbed the wharf in violent light. Cleavers shone, knocking through heads of fish. Flies whirled and crawled on rocking mutton quarters. Blinking fowls huddled in cages. Curs bickered over trash. I couldn't be a shell which dies, and not to initiate some eventual glory, an unfolding of wings and promise of flight, nor even to leave behind an ornate shape upon the sand, but in the service of a slug-like and onward concatenation, to maintain the cycle of capitulate transformation of a child to hard-mouth factotum, to that flat and sallow slattern, wiping asses of and cleaning behind ears of and setting pots of scorched porridge before whelps and mending rags in shadow and in sullen and watchful resentment and taking a dick like a flattened hen or as a moke with a twisted ear takes the harness and all this under a roof wrapped round by a slat fence that you don't bother to fix because you know that what it fences is ultimately nothing but a hard scrabbled concatenation of a blind and motile appetence. Sputtering lasers, the sun played upon rows of barred windows like harp strings, wobbling from a glaring, back-beaming building so tall you had to bend your spine to see its top. Like sheep on the wing, buzz bikes came bleeding, and curs giggled, and in the socket of some alley, a radio muttered. In a narrow ribbon of shade at the base of a pumice-colored low-rise, she broke a seam in her bag, tearing into a hidden pocket where she'd tucked the scrap with the address in Y's handwriting, and she pulled it out and unfolded it, wending on in a flux of men, unicycles, steaming phaetons and cabriolets, wagon loads of finger limes and melons. Hammers echoed and steam drills rattled and whelps raised begging bowls. In bottle-littered entrances, stolid women done up in scarlet plumage smoked and beckoned to anyone. Before a group of migs with bare thighs and fur-trimmed boots, she showed the address, and they all pointed along a raised and rattling omnibus track. She stood before a narrow tenement building with bars over the windows. She mounted the mesh iron platform where a rat smashed in the grid, bared yellow teeth. The iron door swung open, and she caught it and climbed to a charred landing where she stood looking at the numbers stamped among tongues and glue on the inner door. She pulled out the neckerchief from her bag and wiped her face. She picked up the movable link and tapped. The door swung in, and a woman with a lipless mouth peered out both ways, framed by the iron diamond, as if to make out some threat back of the perspiring mig on her landing. "Pardon me, is this the home of E. Sincross?" The woman ran the back of her hand under her nose. "Sincross? Could be the old woman who lived here. Died about a year back. I live here now, me and Bill Bray." Back out on the foot pavement, she wiped her neck with the cloth. She passed under a stone entablature into a vast and echoic hall. She reached a door assigned "Ladies" and "Pennies Only," and heard a trickle of water beyond the wrought iron grid. Outside, she leaned against a colonnade. Edifices towered pale in the heat. Each could house entire villages with dark bands under their cornices, like stone warriors on a millennial watch. Devouring a green apple, she wobbled back down the steps. A dray in blinders was clopping past, throat shining, wine-stained under the harness. Outside, tarp edges glossed the ice. She trudged on, searching the gutter for a penny. She came to a canal bridge, where she rested on the rail, thinking, "If only I can find one penny, I can pay the ferry back before the cockfighting ends. Wash the barrel guts, start the soup, clear out that back area fast. Pretend to be sick, maybe. Ah, but he will know." Halfway up a rise, she came again upon the ice wagon, now with pavers blocking its rear wheels. Beneath the end gate, lines of droplets were feeding rivulets. A crowd had gathered about the hitch. With the driver at its head, the dray lay still, eyes half closed, legs stiff, nostrils flaring over the pool. Someone tipped a bucket, and the stony jaw streamed. The head rocked, the tail lashed, and the hooves scraped cobblestones. It rested with wide-open nostrils, ribs heaving. She wiped her brow with the soaked handkerchief. Before her, the crowd and yellow and green patchwork mingled in a dizzy, adulterated mash. A wart-studded, bespectacled man with a pouch joining his chin and neck was deploring the fate of the dray. "Driver says he's 12. Says he tripped. Bloody hell, these drivers push their horses. That ice will not last in this heat. He ought to let folks have at it." The man stood disheveled in his straining, paint-splattered shirt, his smile bland and constant over a wobbling gullet, his skin gray-brown as the city. Droplets of sweat slid along the lines of his forehead. "Where are you from? What are you doing here? Do you know, a flower in your hair and you'd look quite like a model, very famous in her day. Victorine Miron. Around her quay, stonefish lie knobbed and spiked,
blending in at the bottom of pools on rocky shoals, thick lips frowning, fins clasping the bottom. Between turbaned forecheeks, the man's solemn, woody eyes measured hips, breasts, the length of her neck. If you are dying of hunger, you'd do better than to cast stones at a stonefish. All he will want is that. Better that than the other. Aldegund put her up in a boarding house. When he was feeling well, she'd sit for him in his studio, a room with Queen Horsenet drapes. Among lampshades like skirts of firewalkers, stuffed chairs supported gold-framed paintings of naked children in hats. Upon an iron stand, a tank bubbled. The eel within budded and displayed a pearly belly, a frill about the flattened club of its tail. Wheezing and shuffling like a hamstrung boar, Aldegund would trundle out his wheeled bench laden with paint tubes. As he worked, the scent of tongue oil pervaded the studio. The palette knife would click. Wearing only pumps, she'd lie upon a heap of white Dutch wives, the black ribbon of Olympia about her neck, a yellow bracelet upon her wrist. Sitting required presence, like that of the white-clad fisherman that she'd see between boarding house and studio, silhouetted against the full platinum glare, a race of physicians waiting for ailing pontiffs or princes sick with love.